All right, and we're gonna go in three. Are we recording this?
I know.
I hope so.
When do we count down?
I was just checking. I was just making, because Bill normally jumps in just as I'm ready to go, when I've psyched myself up to be the professional broadcaster that we know I can be, but never am.
Right.
I'm gonna go. See.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple Garak.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast.
And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland, Paul Spataro, and Dr. Bill Robinson.
Bloody hell.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, a Two True Freaks presentation. We are your podcast guy. Oh, no, that's a different show. Anyway, we're here to look at every single episode of Deep Space Nine, the good, the bad, and the downright awful. Today, however, it's better than good, it's certainly not bad, and it definitely isn't downright awful. As ever, I am Andrew Leyland, and I am joined by my two compatriots on this deep space station, going through the wormhole, looking at what's through there, and probably not liking what we see. Dr. Bill Robinson.
I'm just a big tribble.
And not Dr. Paul Spataro.
Who started it? Who started it?
Bill,
I know you. You started it, didn't you?
Very good. I see what you did there. Because this is such a momentous occasion, we have had to invite a fan of such stature, such gravitas, someone of such import.
And the guy who happened to be up.
But he wasn't available because he decided to go to Disneyland instead. So instead, we roped in Mr. J. David, you can call him Dave, Weeter, and I actually think we got the better end of the deal. Hello, Dave.
Hello. You're all going to feel really goofy when you get to the end of this podcast and find out I don't exist. Because I didn't meet my great-grandmother.
Ooh. Hmm.
And shagger in a turbo lift.
Yeah.
Going up.
You know, mopping those things has got to be awful.
Can you imagine going in with the light, the black light?
Oh.
And as you may have noticed,
is there a turbo lift version of the 3 Mile Club?
Loving the turbo lift, getting it up when I'm going down. Shh. Get out.
That's the turbo. I was never mind.
Deck 21, lingerie.
Deck 5, Captain Kirk's quarters. Oh yeah.
Wait, deck 2, condoms. Oh, sorry.
They're an alien, aren't they? The condoms.
Exactly.
Today on the show is a very special one. We are looking at 30 years of Star Trek, even though we're actually 50 years of Star Trek as we record this. So we're looking at 20 years of this. I don't know anymore.
We're looking at years.
We're looking at years. This is Trials and Tribulations. But before that, do we have any Star Trek news?
We have podcast news.
Ooh, give us podcast news.
I have been officially kicked up from the producer position to executive producer.
Ooh, management
to say
anything.
Well, that's the beauty of it. Management has decided that the on-air talent isn't responding to the same message over and over again, and it's time to bring in a new voice, one that, you know, with a new message that you guys may, you know, actually listen to. So I've been given an executive position, much like Gene Roddenberry, I guess, towards the end, and Dave has taken over as producer on the show.
Yeah, we got to talk about your TPS cover sheets, by the way.
I think more importantly, Dave, you should be talking to Paul about your enumeration, because we're in season 5 of this year, and I have yet to see a single dime.
And you will continue to not see a single dime. I have anything to say about it, Leyland.
Andy, that's because this is Star Trek, and we don't get paid in money.
That's bullshit.
You get paid in We are paid in satisfaction.
We have a higher sensibility.
Action is your reward, Dandy.
Thank you for that.
All right. So, see, now, Dave, as producer, has already learned one of the tricks of the trade. how to shut Andy up when he asks for money. It's probably the hardest part of the job.
You still got your and credit, Andy.
Oh, do I? Oh, as long as I have the and, I'm perfectly happy. Because we need to talk the credit situation then. So it's Listen to the Prophets, hosted by Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Andrew Leyland. Produced by J. David Wheater. I can live with that. That's a good set of credits.
Yeah, so we're good.
Yeah, yeah. We have no problem.
That is your money.
yeah, that and £2.50 will buy me a cup of coffee.
But wait a minute. How did you... How have you really advanced, Paul? Because... Okay, so you became the executive producer and you don't do anything, but Andy and I don't do anything either, and we're not producers or executive producers. Aha.
You're flotsam and jetsam.
I'm a whole lot of flotsam. Or am I jetsam?
I think you're more jetsam.
I get the corporate credit card is what happens.
And it's still, there's with the balance and everything.
And every once in a while I get to send a memo to Dave saying, change this, change that. I need a better chair.
I'm still waiting on my Papa San.
I'm not sure what the punchline to that is.
No, I've never gotten my Papa San, so I wouldn't hold out too much hope.
I don't know what Papa San was.
I broke it. It's one of them bamboo chairs.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That would explain why I didn't know what it was.
Oh, that makes a little more sense. It's like a big bowl, like a cushy bowl.
Ooh, I want that and a jetpack.
I've been waiting on mine.
Hey, we'll do trickle down. Mine.
By the way. Just as a tip of the hat, I did hear you say that on Fantasticast, Andy.
Yeah,
I'm sure you said it as a specific callback to our jetpack.
I did indeed. Yes, I'm glad that you got that. I like to slide stuff in the synopsis of that show that goes straight over Steven's head.
Well, I suspect that one may have, because I doubt that he listens to this.
No, but it's fun though, isn't it? Do you not remember the one? I think only Michael Bailey got this. My entire synopsis was Incredible Hulk TV show episode titles.
Oh, no, I didn't get that because I wouldn't have recognized that.
I was very proud of that one.
That is pretty cool.
Anyway, I've not got Star Trek news. I've got kind of semi-related to Deep Space Nine news. I've started watching, well, Angela wanted to watch, Outlander. I don't know if you guys have ever seen this. I think it's 4 or 5 seasons in now, but we've only just started getting the first season on free TV. And it's developed for television by a novel by Ronald D. Moore. One of the producers on the show is Iris Stephen Burr. And there's a number of other familiar names as well from both Battlestar Galactica and from Deep Space Nine. And I should like it because it's a girly romance.
I'm going to say, that girly romance.
Yes, but listen. You're looking right. Listen to the prophets. You're looking at it exactly like I did. Oh, God, this is a girly romance thing. And it's about this girl who falls through time from the end of World War II, I think, but it may be World War I, back into the 1800s, into the English occupation of Scotland. And it's her, with all her futuristic knowledge, dealing with the Scots and the English. And it's actually really good. I was pleasantly surprised by how entertaining the show is. It's really good. And it's a time when we were bastards, and I think we should be bastards again. But no, it is actually worth watching. If you're a bloke,
I believe we are,
and you're put off by the fact that this was a girly romance show. It's actually quite a good show. It's really fun.
That's how I got into Gilmore Girls. You think I'm making a joke? No, I actually love Gilmore Girls, but
I love Gilmore Girls.
You'll find no Gilmore haters here, Paul.
I'm not a Gilmore hater because I've never seen an episode, so I don't even know if I would hate it. It's just not something I've ever watched, and it probably is not anything I ever will watch.
I would say give it a chance. It's on Netflix.
I have so much stuff in my queue already. I have to find out who this Clem Fandango is.
I can hear you, Clem Fandango.
I did my research. I went onto YouTube and just watched the opening, just because you guys did it so much.
And a quality entertaining show it is too. But we are not here to talk about Toast of London, a Channel 4 sitcom starring Matt Berry. Oh, go on.
Hold on. I would be Jetsam.
Oh, okay.
Because I looked up the difference, because I couldn't remember.
Were you just doing a Hitchhiker's Guide gag there? would make us wait all the way to the end for Arthur bruised his upper arm.
So, Bill, why don't you take a moment and define flotsam and jetsam for everybody?
Flotsam is the debris that results from, basically, results from a shipwreck or accident. Jetsam is the stuff that is deliberately thrown overboard, hence why would be me, by the crew of a ship in distress, most often to lighten the load. That's why. So I'd be jetsam, not flotsam.
Yes, I think I'm clearly flotsam. I'm just a shipwreck waiting to happen.
We did talk about this off air, a little bit of Star Trek news. The rumor is, and it's a fairly strong rumor, that Universal is going to be putting in a Star Trek themed land in the next few years to compete with Star Wars.
Cool.
That's right. Dave's got his plans for his job, and I'm going to apply to be the big the guy in the big tribble costume walking around. Nothing creepy there.
Can I be a Gorn? Love to be a Gorn.
I would make a great Gorn because I'm slow moving.
I can just see like people like, "Daddy, take a picture of me with a big tribble. Get away from that thing."
That's not licensed.
See, I mean, you know, God.
Security. We've got a giant tribble in the park. Is anybody know about a costume?
That I find really funny is you show up there every day in your giant tribble costume, but you're not even actually employed by them. But I, as I said when we discussed this earlier, although I know we would love something like that, I don't know if the current audiences out there would embrace a Star Trek land as much as they would embrace a Star Wars land.
It depends on the quality of the attractions, though.
I think that's always what it's going to come down to, because I am hearing a lot of things about the Avatar thing in Orlando, and that it's very, very popular right now. And I kind of thought that movie was out of the public consciousness at this point and that the land was going to be a huge flop. So the fact that that's doing well, I guess, is a tribute to the quality of the attractions. Mm-hmm. Or just the fact that there's something new and people just get a buzz about it because, you know, it's been whatever, 2 years since there's been anything new in Disney.
Well, there's also, I think Scott Gardner has mentioned this before, Animal Kingdom needs something.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise it's just a massive zoo, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a half day park at best.
Well, Animal Kingdom has the the mission to the one with the Yeti in it, the roller coaster.
Yeah, have you read that?
Yes, that's definitely the best ride in Animal Kingdom, at least in my humble opinion. But there were probably, I think, maybe 5 rides in Animal Kingdom that were really worth doing. And because the crowds weren't as big in Animal Kingdom, you could get those 5 rides in the morning. So, yeah, it was for me, it's when I've been there, it's always been a half-day park. So this may turn it into a full-day park, especially the way right now with these Avatar rides, apparently the lines are very long.
Yeah, that'll turn it to a full day park.
Yeah, well, just to get on whatever it is, 3 rides, I think, 4 rides. That might be the whole day waiting online. You know, I think at least right now you have to be very patient to get on those rides.
Well, I'm out. Sure, there's some type of size thing too.
It's always about size.
It doesn't matter.
Go ahead, sit. Go in the virtual roller coaster. You'll fit. Yeah, sure.
Oh yeah, that's right. That was Animal Kingdom.
No, that was at the other place that's been torn down now.
That wasn't Ekpot?
No. No, that was the Disney play thing in, Disney Quest.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I used to quite like Disney Quest.
Yeah, did you ever go on the virtual roller coaster? I didn't. I couldn't fit in the
Ekpot. It wasn't for lack of trying, though.
Most humiliating thing in my life.
And let me tell you, that's going somewhere right there.
Somebody send out maintenance. We got a guy stuck in a pod.
I'm pretty sure.
Sir, can you breathe in? No, I can't breathe in. I'm sitting here like Miles Tyson from Terminator.
You see the roller coaster explode.
Can we clean the guy in the tribal costume out of the simulator?
But I'm pretty sure when you start putting together the most embarrassing things in your life, there's some severe competition for that.
No comment.
Till the time limit's up.
Yeah.
Statute of limitations, yeah.
I don't know if it's news or we'll wait till the end where I talk about books, because I finished up a couple audiobooks.
I finished up a book too, Bill.
Ooh, should we have a book corner at the end?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, all right. But that's Andy, you may proceed.
Can I carry on now?
Carry on.
All right, hold on a second.
Wayward son.
Yeah, that's where I went too, but I can't help but think of Supernatural now.
And why not? Nothing wrong with Supernatural.
New season's up on Netflix, Andy. Start watching.
Just because we like to divert into things that have nothing to do with the show, I always think of the commercial for the movie Heroes with Henry Winkler and Sally Field that was like 1977. Never saw the movie, but the commercial had that song on it. And that's always the pop culture reference I get from hearing that song.
Well, you're doing it wrong. You should watch all 5 seasons of Supernatural. There were no further seasons after all 5 seasons.
Well, then you don't get Baby, which was a great episode, and the Scooby-Doo one, which was really fun.
But they're one-offs compared to whole seasons that were, you know, appointment television for 5 years.
Yes, that's very true.
It's been appointment television for 13 years. Going on 14 now.
I really need to retire so I could just watch all these TV shows and do nothing else.
Or I get George Lucas rich, where you can just give $4 billion
away. I want to be like the people on the ship on Wally. Anyways, right. Moving it on.
Have we done with news?
We have no news. So, no. Yeah, I think so.
Prepare for an unforgettable hour of television.
God, that's him.
Oh, Kirk. An historic encounter between two legendary crews.
He's so much more handsome in person.
Together in one of Star Trek's most beloved adventures.
They are detestable creatures.
This?
Celebrate an extraordinary event you'll have to see to believe.
It's too much, Father.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Trials and Tribulations was the 6th episode of Season 5. It was directed by Jonathan West, and the story was by Ira Stephen Burr, Hans Beimler of Robert Hewitt Wolf. The teleplay was by Ronald D. Moore and René Acavaria. It aired originally in the week of November 4th, 1996, was just a couple of months after the 30th anniversary of Star Trek. On board Deep Space Nine, Captain Benjamin Sisko, Avery Brooks, is being queried by Department of Temporal Investigations agents Dulmer, Jack Blessing, and Luxley, James W. Jansen. We'll talk about those anagrams later. The captain explains that he was on the USS Defiant returning from Cardassian space with a Bajoran Orb of Time. That sentence would only happen on this show. They had picked up a hitchhiker on the way, a human called Barry Waddle. Really? Suddenly the ship found itself some 200 light years away from its previous location and 100 years in the past, near Deep Space Station K7, and found the USS Enterprise in orbit. The original, no A, B, C, or bloody D, or E, as there is now. They discover that the hitchhiker was Arn Darvin, played by Charlie Brill, a Klingon agent who had previously been caught by Captain James T. Kirk, William Shatner, on K7 whilst trying to poison a shipment of grain. Storage compartments? Fearing that Darvin may be attempting to assassinate Kirk, the crew dress in period uniforms and investigate the Enterprise. They attempt to interact with history as little as possible whilst investigating Darvin. The crew does not initially recognise the Klingons of the time period, and when Worf, Michael Dorn, is asked about the difference in appearance, he replies that the matter is not discussed with outsiders. Dr. Julian Bashir, Alexander Siddig, and Chief Miles O'Brien, Col Meany, are involved in a bar brawl between the Enterprise crew and a number of Klingons on shore leave. Captain Kirk disciplines them on the Enterprise alongside Chief Engineer Montgomery Scott, James Doohan, and Ensign Pavel Chekov, Volta Koenig. Bashir and O'Brien notice that the ship is covered with Tribbles, played by Tribbles. Lieutenant Commander Worf, Michael Dorn, and Odo, René Auberjonois, detain Darvin and return him to the Defiant, though Darvin admits that he planted a bomb in a Tribble to kill Kirk. Sisko and Lieutenant Jadzia Dax, Terry Farrell, board the Enterprise but can find no trace of a bomb. They travel to K7. Scans indicate that the bomb is in the grain storage compartments. Storage compartments? They enter the compartments and discover that the poisoned grain has all been eaten by Tribbles, who are all now dead. Suddenly, Captain Kirk opens the compartment and is covered in falling Tribbles. Dax and Sisko find the bomb before it can kill Kirk, and the Defiant transports into space where it explodes. The crew of the Defiant use the Bajoran Orb to travel back to the present time, and Sisko finishes explaining the situation to the Temporal agents. The episode ends with Quark, Armin Shimmerman, in his bar on Deep Space Nine's promenade with numerous Tribbles around him. Nobody makes a bad Tribble joke. That synopsis was courtesy of Wikipedia. It's very good. Yes, I like that. I don't got nothing on this other than, wow, this is good.
Yes.
This is, I would assume for most people, the high point of this series.
Oh,
I think if you took a poll of DS9 watchers and asked them for their 5 best episodes, I'm betting this would rate highest.
Impale Moonlight would probably beat that one out, I would hope.
I think you can argue that that's a better episode. I don't think it's as much in the consciousness of watchers or viewers as this is.
Well, this one was, I mean, this is candy, because even people who weren't DS9 fans would come see this episode. And the ratings showed it, apparently.
Yeah, well, I remember when they showed this, and I remember that was back in the days when I still got TV Guide. And I remember it was they were making a big deal in TV Guide because you had this, and you also had Scorpion going on in Voyager. So it was like two event shows on the Star Trek spinoffs. And I had fallen from my DS9 viewing, as I did with every spinoff except for Discovery. I watched the pilot, and then I kind of just lost a little bit of interest, and then later on watched all the episodes and picked it up. And this is the one that actually got me back interested. I watched this one, and then I started watching it weekly. It used to be on Channel 9 at, I think it was 7 o'clock on Saturday nights, the new episodes. So I started, you know, setting my VHS timer for it. But it was already in reruns and syndication on some channel. I couldn't even tell you what. But I also started setting the timer for that to get caught up on what was going on. And so during the course of season 5, I managed to get caught up on the prior episodes and continue to watching the new ones. So that by episode 6, I was totally up to speed. Or by season 6, rather, I was totally up to speed. But this worked on me, is the point of that. Is, you know, I had lost interest in it, and hearing about this one, I decided to watch it. I loved it, and I started to get interested in, you know, who are these crew members and what's their deal. And that was it. The rest is history. But I think it's worth talking about the underlying episode a little bit, which I think is greatly celebrated by Star Trek fans. And I was thinking about, you know, do I have any real negatives? And I've heard people say, you know, the comedy aspect of it was a little too much for them, was one of the criticisms. That didn't bother me at all. I'd say the only thing that I don't like about the original episode is the score when things happen, and it's the kind of that whiny sound that they do. And I always just found that really irritating. But other than that, I love the original episode. And I thought they really, really did a good job of integrating it into this one, Forrest Gump style, seamlessly.
Seamless was the word I had in mind, yeah. And I watched the remastered version.
I don't think I've seen a remastered version, unless I have and didn't realize that's what it was.
It is an extra on the TOS Blu-ray set. And I didn't include
on the TOS?
Yeah.
Oh, the remastered version of the original or this?
Both, but
on the TOS?
Yeah, on TOS, the DS9 episode is an extra, because Trouble with Tribbles is actually, it ends up being its own disc, and then there's special features.
Okay, I have not gotten to that yet, because I do have the TOS Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm. It's season 2, disc 5, I think.
I'll have to take a look. I'm looking at the box sitting on my shelf right now.
But I was sitting there looking at the CGI model of the Enterprise, I'm like, wow, that still looks really good today. Oh, wait.
Now, story-wise, was it necessary for Arn Darvin to take the entire
Defiant? Have a Brooklyn accent?
Oh, sorry.
was it necessary for him to take the entire Defiant through time, or could he have just done it himself?
Yeah, well...
I know, obviously, we don't have an episode if he doesn't take the Defiant.
I think they should redefine this orb, because it's actually the orb of space and time, because they went 200 light years also, you know, because, yeah, I was kind of like, okay.
Well, there's another nitpick I didn't have before doing this.
Sorry.
I don't know if he had that much control over the orb, to be honest with you.
He must have, because he went to exactly when and where he wanted to.
But I don't... Well, I mean, if he had transported himself, he'd be trying to aim for either K-7 or the Enterprise and just magically appear there, even though he's bringing
magically
an entire
delicious
24th century starship back. That one just kind of falls apart as I think about it.
Yeah, to an extent. Okay. How familiar are you guys with Charlie Brill, other than these two episodes?
He
was in these two episodes.
See, he's been on other things.
I know him. He was a comedian back in the 60s.
What?
And I've seen him on old episodes of The Ed Sullivan Show. And he and his wife, Mitzi McCall, were on Tattletales frequently. And he was actually pretty cool. He had a big, you know, you'd never know it from these episodes. He had a big mop of hair and like a, you know, late 60s, early 70s mustache.
Well, you know how he came to be in this episode, how this episode kind of came to be. Because they were tossing around something to do for the 30th anniversary, and they were throwing around ideas. And the writers happened to go to a pizza place where Charlie Brill was eating. And they didn't officially negotiate, but they're like, yeah, we should do Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh, his wife was kind of hot. Sorry.
She was like the definition of cute. And they played that aspect of her up. You know, they would talk about how cute she is, and she would kind of do the dimple smile.
So she was like Sally Field.
Yeah.
To an extent. Only like I said, a little bit more of a self-aware version. She's still around. Every once in a while you see her in a guest spot, she'll be like on a show, like a Disney, one of those Disney sitcoms or whatever, and she'll be like one of the kids' grandmothers or something like that.
I guess he was on Silk Stockings for a while, too, which was, I think, was on USA, if I remember correctly.
According to Wikipedia, the two of them were married in 1960, and they're still together, which is, you know, it's nice to see that in Hollywood relationships.
I think he looked pretty good. Not sure what he looks like now, but I think he looked better as the older version of himself than the younger version. He had more, gravitas to himself. I don't know. I like the older version better than the younger version. The younger version seemed kind of sniveling.
I think he was supposed to be.
Well, good point. Hadn't thought of that.
Whereas in the remake one, he's a man who's 20 years removed and pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
So he was probably supposed to be a little bit more.
20. He's 100 years from that point.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about
really pissed off.
So, yes, he would be plenty pissed off. One of the things I did like that the two temporal investigators, one of which is McGillicuddy from Moonlighter.
Oh.
Who recently died, sadly.
Oh.
Now, which one was that?
McGillicuddy's Jack Blessing, the shorter one with the blonde hair.
Okay. And who's the other guy? Was that James Jansen? Does he have any history to speak of?
I think he's...
He's familiar in the sense that he's a that guy.
Yeah, he really doesn't have a Wikipedia page to speak of. You said there was something with the anagrams?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the names were an anagram of Mulder and Scully.
Oh, I didn't even know that. That's cool.
He even says, you know, Six was like, what do you want? They say the truth.
I did like the Temple Investigations people because you do get the impression that they're just snooty, officious bureaucrats all the way through the episode. And I love the line, we don't want a visit from Temple Investigations. But then you get to the end and McGillicuddy, he's always McGillicuddy to me because of Moonlighter. McGillicuddy actually says, yeah, I'd have probably done that as well. Yeah. And his mate just looks at him like, what?
I just like when they talk about Kirk and the man was a menace.
Yeah. 37 separate violations. I can just imagine Kirk being interviewed these guys after Star Trek 4. And you didn't think that bringing two whales 400 years in time could affect the timeline in any way. And I just see him sat there with a cup of coffee going, fuck off.
Actually, there is a list of those violations I found.
All right.
I can read them if you want.
I think if you can go through them quickly, unless it's, you know, something where you have to give a lot of details to go through them.
No, okay. One, beaming aboard a 20th century Earth Air Force pilot. Two, beaming aboard a 20th century guard. Three, breaking into a military base in 1969 and getting caught. Four, stealing clothes and clashing with law enforcement in 1930. Five, beaming aboard two New York City policemen in 1968. Six, breaking into a military base in 1968, getting caught and beaming out, risking being seen doing so. Seven, helping to sabotage a rocket launch in 1968. Eight, being involuntarily transported into Serendipian's past. Nine, giving information about transparent aluminum. That's all we'll say there. Ten.
That's not Kirk.
Wait.
It's under his command.
It says, although this can be attributed more to Scotty than Kirk, with Scotty speculating that they were merely preserving history by providing blah, 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 blah. But it was him.
So it's under his command. He's responsible.
Yes. 10, bringing two whales from 1986 to save Earth from the cessation probe. 11, bringing back Gillian Taylor to the 23rd century. 12, leaving...
that's a pretty big one.
12, leaving Klingon technology on board the USS Enterprise CVN-65. Chekhov throws his non-functioning phaser at his captors while trying to escape. which I had totally forgot that one.
Mm.
13, allowing bones to cure a patient in 1986 with 23rd century medicine.
The doctor gave me a pill and I grew a new kidney.
And she went on to become like Angela Merkel or something. Anyway, 14.
So it would be funny if she was the one that caused the mirror universe to start existing. She became kidney queen.
Kidney queen.
No.
Young and... Oh, anyway. 14, not concealing the use of a phaser and a decloaking of a Klingon bird of prey in 1986 and scaring the hell out of a Norwegian trawler. 15, temporal investigations may not know about this, as McCoy may be unaware his phaser went missing and a homeless man killed himself with it.
That's remember? True. Yeah.
Yep. this one is kind of 16, taking work, money, housing, and food that others would have been employed at, spent, or saved, or consumed. So they were illegal time immigrants.
That's a bit of a reach, that one.
But we do talk butterfly effect, so every little thing can influence.
They stole those clothes, and some guy was late for work, and he came home, and he smacked his kid, and his kid fell down and got hurt, and it changed the whole course of history. Anyway, okay. 17, after Kirk saved the USS Enterprise B from being destroyed in the Nexus, he was swept into the energy ribbon, although from his point of view, Kirk was altering future events. He technically went into the past by agreeing to assist Captain Picard stop Zorn. However, Picard altered past events by preventing the destruction of the Viridian system and the survivors of the USS Enterprise D. Kirk would have known that by leaving the timeline, he would be assisting Picard alter the timeline by preventing the torpedo launch. That's some of his supposed 17 violations.
The 17th one is kind of a cop.
Yeah.
There's a few of them that are picayune, but still.
Well, just the same. It is the time organization, and they are picky.
Yes. And I read a book with those guys in it, and it was kind of interesting, although now I cannot remember any of it because it's been years since I read it.
And the timeline has changed. Mind.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, yeah.
One of the other ideas that they had for this that I think is worth noticing, they did want to go back to the piece of the action planet.
Mm.
One of the first ideas that Ron Moore had was
Vic Tayback still alive?
I do not know if Vic Tayback was still alive then. He may have been.
Oh, what was his name? Was it Krak? No, wait a minute. Bella Oxnix?
Was he Krakow? Oxnix?
Bella Oxnix, I think, Oxnix was the other guy.
Yeah, Oxnix was the other guy.
See,
with the thick-rimmed glasses. I remember the shit all the time as well. Why do I remember that it's Sigma Iosha? Of what possible use is that to me in everyday life? Well, what planet did they go to in the one where everyone was ruled by Chicago gangsters? Oh, that was Sigma Iosha. Yeah, that'll get me a table in a restaurant.
Absolutely it will.
Write it down on a piece of paper and slip it in the Major D's hand.
Maybe at Quark's bar.
Maybe at this new Universal Studios land.
There you go.
Hey, how you doing?
They ask you trivia to get your seat.
Yeah, and if you can answer it, you get the best seat in the house and lots of green Darbo girls dancing around you.
Mm. Well, I like where this is going. I'm going to crack out my encyclopedia when we're done.
So the whole setup for the episode is just to have some fun, let's be honest. All of the special effects of the Enterprise outside K7 are gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Even now in HD. 20 years later, they still look absolutely fantastic. And I never understand why stuff like Discovery, and I'm not dissing on Discovery because I quite enjoyed it, but I never understood why things like Discovery have to reinvent the sets and the costumes, because there's nothing wrong with that Enterprise.
I was thinking the same thing when I was watching the episode, because the Enterprise that shows up at Discovery looks nice, but it wasn't broken to begin with. It's never been broken.
No. It's the only one that was designed with NASA's input, isn't mm-hmm. it?
Yep.
So it's the only one that actually has the genuine feel of what a starship would be. I mean, the only show that comes close for me for stuff like that is Space 1999, with the design of the Eagle that genuinely looks like something NASA would make. But I don't understand the redesigning of the Enterprise for stuff like JJ's films and for Discovery, because as proven here, and in that episode of Enterprise with the Mirror Universe episode, I know it wasn't the Enterprise, it was the Defiant, but there's nothing wrong with the design work of the 60s shows. Nothing.
It's only when you come to have a look at the actual filming of it, some of the sets, yes, are very 60s. And what I did like about this is they employed as a director of the episode, the director of photography, because he would have the eye to be able to match up the shots. They dug out old film to film the show on. Mm-hmm. That they used in the original 1960s stuff. But when they were doing the lighting, they had to dig out old light bulbs mm-hmm. to be able to do that harsh 60s TV lighting to be able to match it up. And it's flawless.
It stands out. It was at the time, at the end of this season, it was the most expensive hour of television ever. And yeah, all of that is on the million? Screen.
No, except it wasn't in that one Klingon guy that fought Cole Meady. They didn't spend a lot on that guy's hairpiece.
No, a lot of the her pieces.
Oh, I think that was intentional, though.
I know. It's just like, wow. So wait for that thing to fall off. Now that I've derailed it. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, watching this, as far as the temporal timeline, did you see any violations that really had the potential to change time?
Yes.
Besides the bomb? Cisco.
Besides the bomb. Well, the bomb, they derailed the bomb so that they saved time in that respect. But what do you know, as far as other stuff in the episode, little things, little butterfly effect things, was there anything in particular that you thought, oh, that's going to have ramifications?
Yes. Barry Russo was not in the lineup when it was either Cole Meany or Bashir that took his place. Barry Russo's the same actor that would play Commodore Wesley in The Ultimate Computer.
The Ultimate Computer, yeah.
Because I was like, wait a minute, he's not there. Where's he at?
I thought they bumped him down on the other side of Bashir.
Nah, I didn't see him at all.
No, they replaced him.
Yeah, because he's one of the... Yeah, I know. I'm being an ass, so...
No, well, the little minor things like that is when they're all ordered to leave and Kirk keeps Scotty behind... Mm-hmm. Bashir and O'Brien walk out and Chekhov is right behind them. But then when they walk out of the turbo lift into the corridor, Chekhov's nowhere to be seen for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So there's little minor gaffes like that. But I thought, for the most part, my favourite bit is putting Jadzia on the bridge when Kirk's trying to drink his coffee. Yeah. He sits on the tribble and he looks over to what in the original episode is nothing. There's nobody stood there.
Right.
And he looks
he's
over to
like...
Jadzia, yeah. And Jadzia just kind of looks at him. And it looks like it was shot that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really did think this was pretty seamless, as we mentioned earlier in this. I think they did a really good job of picking the scenes that they used and worked into it. I think the gag that I get, well, the two gags, actually, that I get the biggest kick out of in the episode are both in the bar scene. And one is, you know, Worf saying, we don't talk about that. and the other is Meany. There he is, it's Kirk, that whole thing.
Yeah, but what's really funny about that, isn't he referring to the guy you've seen loads of episodes, who's William Shatner's stunt double?
Yeah. Yes.
So that was a really funny little in-joke. Let's Kirk.
I think it was funny to begin with, and then it's even funnier when you consider the in-joke aspect.
Yeah.
I think the best thing about this episode is that the jokes land. There's not a missed joke in this episode.
No, not one. My favorite is "And Women Wore Less."
Yeah.
that's just absolutely stunning. I think Bashir looks amazing with his Dr. McCoy side parting. And all of his pompous wankery about, she could be my great-grandmother. I am destined to have sex with her. And O'Brien's just looking at him like, what are you smoking, dude? And I love his line about, I can't wait to see your face when I get back. He sounds like C-3PO in my head. I can't wait to see your face when we get back and I don't exist. And O'Brien's like, I could live with that.
But he's also like, think about what you just said. I think the turbo lift bits were the best, where they're trying to get the turbo lift to move.
Yes.
And then she just walks in, you know, turns the knob, and suddenly they're moving up. I just love the look. I won't talk about it if you won't.
She was somebody's girlfriend, but that's okay.
Well, I kept getting her confused with the girl that got turned into salt in by any other name. I thought they had somehow replicated that actress, and I realized, no, this is a completely new actress, because she looks like she's from that time.
Yeah. Yeah, the makeup and costuming on her is just brilliant. She really does look like she stepped out of Trial and Tribulations. I think the guard who picks up O'Brien, he doesn't fit. He's just far too
barrel chested. No, he's way too beefy.
Yeah.
That guy's like, whoa, what have they been feeding him? How many replicator rations have you been taking from people in the commissary, buddy?
O'Brien doesn't quite suit the uniform.
No, it looks awkward on him.
Yeah, I don't quite know what that is. I can't put my finger on it, but you're exactly right. Yeah, it looks awkward. And I think it's because he's got no neck.
Well, to be honest, he is, you know, he is having a little trouble at work, and that's why the doctor's there to, you know...
Workplace stress. Test him.
Yeah. Yeah, workplace stress.
You know who did look good in the uniform? I'm just going to put it out there. Jadzia.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, but you could put Jadzia Dax in anything at this point, and she'd look fantastic.
I didn't have a thing for her until I saw her in the classic uniform, because I think it's the way her hair does that swoop back, but it's not a ponytail, so she's got this big bowl on her head.
And 20 years ago, her character had a thing for Spock, and look how she ended up.
Yes, I thought that was quite... That has ended up being a really funny joke, unintentionally, that she had a thing for Spock, and she's ended up being married to Adam Nimoy.
See, I could take your line, Dave, and just eliminate the very last part of it, and then we're in agreement. Because you said I didn't have a thing for her until I saw her in the uniform, and I would say I didn't have a thing for her until I saw her.
Oh, fair enough. No, it was just the hairstyle that they used on her for the bulk of the show was not flattering.
That's all right. I could deal. I forgot.
So
what
one of the little
I'm thinking of Jed Z. Yeah. I can't think anymore.
Temporal. Not nitpick, but you know the scene where Sisko hands Kirk the datapad is actually from the Mirror Mirror episode when Kirk meets Marlena Moreau.
Yeah.
So Kirk's given Sisko like a creepy, how are you doing?
It does take on a creepy feel when you think of it from that perspective. I guess you're supposed to interpret that as Kirk pretty much knows his crew, and now there's somebody there who he doesn't recognize, or he doesn't recall having seen before. It's what I mean. What is it supposed to be? 300 people on the Enterprise?
400. Yeah.
400. So over the course of the amount of time that they're on there, I think you may not know everybody well, but you've probably seen everybody and kind of recognized them to some extent.
I think that Kirk's the kind of commander who would know everybody, at least by rank and surname.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from being in the service, you might meet the captain once when you come on board, but, you know, you're not going to... I can't say they're going to remember every single crewman all the time. I guess Kirk may, but, you know, it's not expected, at least not in the 20th century military when I was in.
Like I said, I don't think the captain would know everybody by name necessarily, but I think over the course of time, especially when you're spending time, you know, in that closed quarters so much, that he would just have seen pretty much all the faces. And if there was a new face on board, he might think, you know, what's that about? The closest experience I can come to is being on a vacation in either an all-inclusive resort or on a cruise ship, and you just start to see the same faces over and over again over the course of a week, and you start recognizing faces. And that's in that circumstance. So I'm thinking, you know, and that's over the course of, say, 5 days. I'm thinking over the course of weeks, months, years, you start having recognition for every face. You know, 400 isn't too many to have seen everybody. Think about, like, when you were in high school, you pretty much knew every other kid in the high school, either by face or by name, even if you weren't friends with them.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, when we went on our six-month cruise, you do tend to, when you're seeing everybody every single day and on a ship. Yeah, yeah.
Which would explain...
You may not have direct interaction, but you recognize that face.
Yeah, and I'm saying
it from the point of view. You're kind of like, oh.
I'm saying it from the point of view of not. I'm not saying that this is a nitpick and a negative. I'm saying it's a nitpick and the positive. That Kirk would see this person and say, you know, at least it would register to him that this is an unfamiliar face.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that he'd flirt with him though.
No, I think he wouldn't. But you
never
know.
Kirk, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, okay.
So Kirk saw Sisko and thought to himself, "I'd hit that."
But Jadzia gives him a look, and he kind of shrugs it off.
Like she wasn't even there.
Yeah. He's not really the Kirk we thought he was.
No. Well, they actually were talking about filming that scene where she gives him that look, and they wanted to make it as short as possible, because if she kept it too long, it would seem odd that he didn't go over to talk to her. So she gives him the nod, and it's done.
Yeah, but then he looks the other direction and he's like, did anyone else see that? Anyone else see the captain sit on a tribble? No, only the pretty girl in the red? Okay, well, we'll just let that go then.
Act like that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Goes around and takes all the tribbles from everybody.
I'm going to get my chicken sandwich and coffee.
No. Do you know, I really like that. I really like that you've got this futuristic setting and everything, and it's so tempting to have my Aldebaran coffee and my thing from ZX-41, and he still has chicken sandwich and coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why the show stayed relatable, because of that. Just little touches like that.
Well, you have books, you have familiar games that have been, 3D chess. It's still chess. There's something that ties it to our time.
So I'm a big fan of that. I don't think there's any... I can't think of any other temporal violations. Can you? I mean, I do love the bit where Jadzia throws the tribble over her shoulder and that's the one that lands on Kirk's head.
Yes,
yeah,
I love
that's
that.
Great.
That's funny. And in fact, the entire episode is just funny.
Which is, a good callback to the original episode. It's a great companion piece to the original episode.
Yeah.
Now, would it have been a bridge too far in Discovery with all the different houses of Klingons to have one that looked like the Klingons from here?
No, I think that would have been great.
And I'm thinking about it from the perspective of everybody. See, now I know people like us would say that's a great callback that they did have Klingons that look like that. But if you were just the casual reader, not particularly into Star Trek, not particularly into Star Trek, and you were watching Discovery because somebody told you it's really good, and you go to one of these Klingon scenes where they're all gathered around, would it stand out too much, and would you say, what the hell is that, and be bothered by it at all?
No, I wouldn't. I think it would just be a case of, look, a human-looking Klingon, that's nice.
Well, I'm trying to remember, and I may be just creating my own headcanon, but I thought that with them, because it is a genetic manipulation viral mutation because of stuff that happens on Enterprise, and I'm trying to remember, did they actually kind of shun those people for a while, so maybe they wouldn't be in positions of power? That's what I'm trying to remember, I don't know where I'm coming up with that. Anybody?
I thought they put them out there to create false trust in other races. Because, hey, we look less threatening. We don't have Snicker bars on our forehead.
Sometimes you're not yourself unless you have a Snicker bar on your forehead.
But
I would have liked to have seen some Koloth, but, instead we got Count Malachi.
They had to get the original actor's
permission. I know
people
are going, who? What? Why wouldn't William Campbell give it? Or was he not a... Was
right?
he
That's
still...
what I was trying to remember, if he was around, if he had passed by then. Or is he still alive? No, he's gone.
No, he's gone.
But Chekhov, Walter Keating, said he got paid 8 times more for that episode.
It's not
the original. Yeah. He's an important person now with keys and credit cards.
Chekhov?
Yeah, it's a Futurama reference.
Oh, sorry.
You're just going over our head.
Sorry. The audience will get it, I'm hoping.
I looked it up. I had forgot that Michael Pataki, who plays the Klingon that insults Scotty, that he was Count Malachi from Happy Days.
Oh. They were going to do a Malachi crunch on Kirk.
Yeah.
This Malachi is a real small guy.
All the way as garbage.
And he even does like the Scottish brogue. He's like, you're right.
Yeah, he mimics Scotty's accent, doesn't he?
You want to reword that, laddie? It's such a good episode. We should have a lot more to say about this because it's just so much fun. The thing that I just think is brilliant is the scenes that they decided to use just work so well.
Cyrano Jones, mm-hmm. walking through.
Yeah,
with the drinks.
That's my only complaint about the episode, is the music score. I know Paul's mentioned that of the tribbles whenever there are. Yeah.
There you go. Oh, I hate that.
But the rest of the score, the rest of Jerry Fielding's score for this one is typically 60s Star Trek, and it's fun and it's bouncy and it's light. The score for this episode is typically 90s Star Trek, and that it's bland and boring. And I know it's not Dennis McCarthy's fault. It says on Wikipedia and in the Deep Space Nine companion, McCarthy wanted to essentially score the entire episode as if he were Jerry Fielding. and score the scenes that had our characters in the same as they were in the original, but add a Deep Space Nine flourish to it. And as usual, Rick Berman said, God, no, we can't have any interest in music in these shows. And so he was left having to do this rather boring score. And it's most evident in the scene with Cyrano Jones and the fight in the bar.
Yeah, it didn't have the same...
No, it doesn't have the oomph, does it? No. It doesn't have the fun to it. It's just, it's kind of flat because the background score's boring. But that's a criticism against all of Deep Space Nine's background scores.
But I just find it funny that in the production meeting that he would say, no, 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 we need the music to be boring.
Yeah, in my head, that's exactly what he did.
But is it that, or is it because we've seen it so many times with the other music and we expect that and we don't get it and we're like, yeah, that just doesn't work.
Yeah, does it? I think viewed on its own, that scene's flat. Independent of what I think of the original Tribbles or whether I've seen the original Tribbles, that scene viewed in isolation in this episode, that music score does not suit that scene.
No, that's fair. I was sitting there thinking, but yeah, it does not work. Not just because it doesn't undertone, you do the punchline, but
yeah.
There's nothing there.
Yeah, the punchline of him taking the thing and he's just about to take the drink. That's it's flat. There's nothing there. And the music is selling that scene because, by God, Stanley Adams is overacting.
They should have put the Eye of Tiger in there. See, that changed that whole scene.
I love all of Dax's just touching the 60s technology, like where she's stroking the tricorder.
Ooh, the silver highlights, the black finish. Ooh.
Yeah, I love that she's us.
Sisko's like, really?
Yeah, she's the geek who's got to go back and be on the Enterprise. And it's done in such an affectionate way. There's none of that patronizing attitude that was in the Voyager 30th anniversary episode.
And it turned out at some point Dax had bumped uglies with McCoy. He has the hands of the surgeon.
Yeah. She gives like a little wink. Like,
yeah.
Sisko's reaction to that is, oh, for keep it in your pants, woman. And I love that as well. I love that progression that in the 60s it was okay for Kirk to be the one who was bedding everyone, and now it's perfectly okay that Jadzia is, you know, puts it about a bit. I thought that was really good. She's allowed to have fun as well, surely. Especially if she looks that good in that uniform.
So Cole Meany, who's the chief engineer, he can't even, you know, he's like, I don't even want to touch anything.
Well, because when he does touch something, it goes bad. Yeah.
Oh, it's because Scotty has that ship so jury-rigged.
Oh, that's... I didn't think of that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Scotty's had to do so much fiddle fuckery.
That's right.
With the engines so and the wiring.
And...
You know, just so Kirk can have his extra 0.5 of a light speed when he needs it, that no one else understands how the Enterprise works. That's why he had to supervise the refit in the motion picture. Other engineers came along and they had a look at the Enterprise and went, I'm not touching this.
Now, in the scene in the bar when they're talking, I thought Cole Meany, just one like little moment that just stood out to me is when he thinks it's Kirk and they said, oh, Kirk, are you sure? And he just kind of looks over with this dismissive look on his face and kind of gives like a half nod and then looks back again. I don't know why, but I just thought that really stood out to me as just being like a very well underplayed scene. Like, you know, I know you obviously don't question me.
Oh yeah, but O'Brien's superior attitude towards Bashir is wonderfully played in this episode because it's one of those shows where Bashir is completely out of his depth. He's not got a clue about this time period or what they're really supposed to be doing. And also O'Brien
with that girl.
Well, if he's lucky, he got some off-scenes fun.
Well, you know, plus he's got his flap open.
Hey!
Your flap's open. What?
You're draining
your
power.
Your tricorder. Oh, thank you. And then she's like, I'll be coming by for my physical tomorrow. 1500.
Wink!
Lieutenant Whatley. Wink, wink.
So is the implication there that she's going to show up for a physical tomorrow with Dr. Bashir and f*** him in the sick bay?
I believe that is exactly the implication, yeah. Except they'll be gone by tomorrow.
Is that the kind of professional behavior that the Federation supports?
When you're trapped on a starship for 5 years, yeah, I mean, get your kicks where you can.
No, I quite like the sexuality of Deep Space Nine. Because if you think about it, a lot of the other Star Trek shows of the 90s were very sexless. in many ways. So it's nice to have a crew of people who acknowledge that, yeah, sex is a part of life. We're going to do it. Deal with it. So that this woman's just actively coming onto Dr. Bashir in the turbo lift and O'Brien's squirming like, you know, I am here, you know?
Yeah.
Stood right here.
But then when he's trying to justify it too.
Yeah.
If I don't have sex with her, I may not come to exist.
I thought that was really fun. I really liked it. I really enjoyed the whole thing. I enjoyed all of this one. I don't think there's, other than the score, there is nothing I can point to in this one that just isn't entertaining. I mean, you can probably nitpick it, but that's not the spirit of it. The spirit of it is just, in The Companion, Alexander Siddig described it as a handshake across 30 years. And I think that's absolutely perfect description of it. That's what it is. It's not patronizing. It's not looking down on it. It's not mocking some of the production value that the 60s shows had. And I still argue, you know, you could put one of those 60s shows up against an equal show like Bonanza. And, you know, Bonanza couldn't make the Ponderosa not look like a soundstage. Star Trek did an alien planet every week. And it's a nice little tip of the hat from the show, and everyone seems to be having fun with it. There's no weak links, and even Worf with his silly little woolly cap on, we do not talk about it. Even that, you know, you could probably have a lot of fun at the expense of that, also be nitpicky about it, but just that one line, for me, that's all I need.
Yeah,
I don't need a two-part episode of Enterprise explaining why the Klingons look different. I just like, we do not talk about it.
I didn't mind that they did it on Enterprise, though. That didn't bother me at all.
No, I enjoyed that two-part episode, and I like that there's a canonical explanation for it, but I'm not bothered by it, and I think the one-line gag in this episode works.
But then by not, and again, I know I'm diverging here, but by not just having some in the background on Discovery, don't they kind of say that canonical reason is, just ignore that, please?
Probably.
Because no, the procedure's different with what they're working on in Discovery.
But they do have, you know, all the different Klingon houses and whatever. True. And like I said, my thought process is just have one house have that appearance about them. And you could update it a little bit, you know, to make them look slightly more Klingon.
Mm.
But have one group with that look, that type of uniform. You know, again, you could update it a little, but, you know, just have that in there. And then it's the continuity all feels right to me then.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough.
Oh, well, this episode I heard a pronunciation of Klingon that you don't hear too often. Klingon.
Yeah.
Is that like
Kristen? And they speak Klingonese.
Klingonese, yes. we had a guest appearance of original Tribbles writer, David Gerald. Gerald. He is like a crew member who's playing with Tribble.
Yep.
Yeah. I think in the hallway shot. Yeah.
Right, brilliant.
And apparently the tribble he has in his hand is one of the originals from the original episode.
Cool. See, stuff like that. It's great, isn't it? Just those little touches, mm-hmm. that attention to detail in it.
There was a lot of work that went into this. They painstakingly went over every frame they could to recreate the bridge.
What was it with the chairs? It was the chairs for the bridge that they had. They actually... The company that made them was out of business, and they found some in storage, and they took that and made a mold to recreate the chairs. The makeup effects, they got like the original makeup guys and you know, how they did all the effects for that. It was just a lot of time and effort was put into this, and it was well worth it.
It came out as a really great love letter to the original series.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think I love, that is really Worf, the bottom line of it.
Worf with his, you know, what is that thing doing here?
Yeah, just his whole reaction and, you know, like talking about them like they're predators.
Yeah, we hunt them down and kill them.
People sing songs of the great Klingon War, of the great Tribble War.
The great Tribble Hunt. What was he said? An armada was sent and decimated the Tribble homeworld. They're an ecological menace. And of course, Odo is not a, he's a human at this point. He's like, there's a Tribble. Oh. He's all into it, loving it, you know. It doesn't like you, Mr. Worf.
I thought I liked all humanoids. Wow, my voice is really gruff today. I'm doing a good Odo.
Yeah, it's working well for your Odo impressions.
Okay. Maybe Bill should have played Odo when we did our dramatic recreation.
What, you mean when he went,
Yes. See, I couldn't go as well as you.
Well, is it time to rate, or are we time to see what Blaine says? Blaine says, what does he say about the Tribbles?
So Blaine's email this time around says, Hi guys, this is one of the episodes produced for the 30th anniversary of Star Trek, as I'm sure you've already mentioned. I don't think we mentioned that. The other was a Voyager episode that shows action parallel to the Star Trek IV The Undiscovered Country, as you've probably already talked about. I don't think we mentioned that either.
I think Blaine's giving us far more credit than we deserve.
I think we've mentioned the anniversary. I don't think we mentioned Voyager because it's Voyager.
Oh, we can mention Voyager.
I don't believe this aired at the same time as the parallel Voyager episode, because I think this aired at right around the same time as Scorpion.
Right.
Because I remember, and we did talk about that. I remember TV Guide highlighting that there was like a big Star Trek shindig coming up, that this episode was coming on, and I'm pretty sure it was Scorpion introducing Seven of Nine. Anyways, this is just plain fun. Some of the blue screening during the fight looks fake, but otherwise the integration of the two series is magnificent, right down to the DP tracking down the original film stock so to keep the look consistent. Also, kudos to Leonard McCoy and Emily Dax.
Oh, digital photography. Okay, I was trying to think what DP meant, and I went, never mind.
Double play.
Director of photography.
Oh, I went digital photography.
Or cinematographer. I don't know what I can add that you wouldn't have covered. There's so much you could add that we didn't cover. There's not much for future implications here, but it has a lot of fun with the past and has an X-Files reference with the anagram of Mulder, misspelled with two U's and no E, and Scully with the temporal investigations. I'm always down for a good X-Files reference, Blaine.
We can briefly mention the Voyager 30th anniversary episode. I think it sucked. Moving on.
I thought it was entertaining. We don't need to go too far into it.
Went from person to person, and they had Sulu on it. Okay, moving on.
I think it sucks, kind of the overall criticism of Voyager.
It is for me. Voyager has its fans, and they are more than welcome to enjoy it. It's just, it doesn't appeal to me. And I thought that Flashpoint had some incredibly condescending lines about the original show from Janeway, which is probably another reason that I don't like her as a character. The Sulu stuff was fine, and it was nice to see Janice Rand. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
I think we could just do our Voyager podcast right now. Okay, so the next episode is dubbing a title here. Yeah, I hated this one.
Yeah. No, that's not true. There's one or two that I like, but the synopsis would normally run, the Voyager runs across a temporal anomaly that does wacky shit, but by the end of the episode, there is absolutely no effect, no character development, and no long-term effect on the series. The end.
To talk like Andy, I'm just being cheeky.
Yes,
literally. There were episodes I definitely liked, but, you know, I'm not enough to do a Voyager show ever.
There was the occasional episode to where, we shortened our trip by some technology we found.
It's only going to take us 200 years now.
Didn't Battlestar Galactica just do Voyager better?
Yes. Voyager squandered all the potential of that type of stranded in space with no Starfleet resources.
Well, the first thing they needed to do was add a Dr. Smith.
I was just going to say.
Dr. Janeway.
So by the end of Galactica, the Galactica was being held together with spit and baling wire.
Yeah.
And Voyager returns home after 17 years or whatever the hell it was. With nothing wrong with it, despite the fact that how many times it had shuttles destroyed and shots through the hull and all of that stuff.
Shot through the hull! Sorry. It just leaped right to my head. Sorry.
Bill wins. Bill's won.
Yeah.
Episode up.
Bill wins. Party time.
Shot through the hole.
Sheriff.
Let's see, Tyrrell's too late. Galactica's landing bays are f***ed. fucked up. I should have said fracked up, though.
Oh, great. Now we could just do all Bon Jovi songs for Galactica.
I'm going to see you guys next time, okay? Yeah, so we should rate it now.
Five.
Oh, I thought you were counting down again, Andy.
No. Five. Four. Three. Two. One. Thunderbirds are go!
Yeah, I'm gonna go next because I'm just gonna be brief. I think this is nearly perfect. I think it's a five. If there are episodes that are better, and there may be, they're not better by enough of a margin to keep this from being a five.
I'm gonna go with five bomb stuff tribbles.
Oh, and I'm going five rectaginos.
Five rectaginos. I'll see your five rectaginos and raise you five bomb stuff tribbles.
Well, we could go five bad Klingon wigs.
Klingon wig, tribble, what's the difference?
And a partridge in a pear tree.
I mean, both make noises and crawl around on their own, so, yeah.
Part of me wants to say 4.5 just to leave that margin for the really strong traditional episodes, but I have to go with 5 as well. There's nothing wrong with this episode.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you like a 5 for dramatic effect and for different reasons, and this is a 5 just because of how everything was integrated and the production value and just the fun.
Heart.
So.
The heart, I would put, where I would put it.
Are we doing an email?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Our first email tonight is from W. Blaine Dowler, not spam, which has become his default response to email in episode 91. Hi, guys. In episode 91, you read an email from Howard Lapp in 67, who said, I may have a response to his question about the Mirror Universe. You guys had good answers, but here are mine. Question one. If it's so easy to move between universes, why is transit from the main universe to the mirror universe so much more common than the other way around? While the real answer is because those are the stories that the writers want to tell, there may be other reasons. It may be easier to travel one way than the other, for instance. Also, we don't necessarily know it isn't happening. If someone comes through the barrier in either direction and meets people who don't know their alternate, assuming they even have a mirror alternate, would their claims be taken at face value, or would they be subjected to psychological evaluation at institutions? Institutionalization. I have more thoughts on this that need to wait until season 7. The thoughts that didn't occur to me until after I'd sent my last email, and I'm debating whether to write another email or to try and use the promise of that idea to wrangle an invite back on the show for the Mirror Universe episode in season 7. Is there no Mirror Universe episodes in season 5 and 6 then?
I think we said there's two Mirror Universes left. And one is definitely in 7, but there's definitely no more in 5.
Right, okay. Question 2, why don't they trap their enemies on the other side? Well, for all the reasons the guy said. Given that the Federation has more enemies than allies in the Mirror Universe, you would just be going to great lengths to turn a powerful single enemy into a much more powerful enemy that can circumvent your borders. Perhaps the greater question is, why Section 31 isn't sending stealth ships into the Mirror Universe to pop out behind enemy lines for target strikes and assassinations? But the real answer to that is that we want to see the action that ends the war and conflicts taken by our main cast, not adversarial guest stars. Bill also said you'd have to ask what Megan meant about the id and the psychology of possession episodes. I'm not really a psychology guy, so you can probably have better qualified listeners to respond to that. Perhaps Megan can write in again. Blaine. Well, I like that bit of Blaine's email where he said, well, the guy's covered everything. Because normally Blaine's scientific explanations are fascinating, but sail right over my head like a deadline of a student.
Okay.
Well, so... and Blaine, you're always welcome to come back. You don't have to just come back for a mirror episode.
He doesn't have to wrangle invitation. He just has to let us know what episode he'd like to be on for, and he's welcome.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know why? Because he's Blaine. That's all.
He's Blaine. He's Blaine.
He's got a song. None of us do.
Bill's is
I thought Bill's was the sad tribble music.
I thought it was the Otis from that's what my son says. Boom boom boom. I'm like, that's not funny, Ben.
Mine's
Mine's the Benny Hill music.
Mine is typically the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme.
Yeah, but Dave,
really looking at the camera.
But yeah, but Dave, our song is, you know, Officer and Gentleman.
Yeah, it'll always be our song.
That's our song was Elton John.
I think the problem is I'm in my mind, I'm hearing the song from Officer and the Gentleman, which, by the way, I do not like, and visualizing Dave and Bill doing the dance from Dirty Dancing.
Hey, baby.
I've reversed it in my mind, and now Bill is doing the leap, and Dave is catching him in the air. And spinning him around in the air. I think we need to get Honeywell to Photoshop that one.
Yes.
Because without the proper special effects budget, we can't create it live. So we need to CGI it.
Nobody puts Weeder in a corner.
They go to put Dave in the corner, but Bill's already there.
Do we have another email we're going to read?
Yeah, I think we have this one from Ben. And it's titled, Long Time Listener, First Time Emailer. Long time in the sense that I discovered your show about a year ago and have since listened through the entire archive from the beginning until what's been posted. As I type this, it's late May, and the most recent episode is The Muse, which I don't know why, but I have to say it that way every time, which I'm sure you recorded in January or something. It's been a lot of fun vicariously re-experiencing Deep Space Nine and seeing its early promise develop as the series figures itself out. Along with an entertaining cast of hosts. Don't agree with you on everything, but as Paul often points out, disagreement is part of the fun of sharing opinions. Anyway, my plan has always been to get caught up before the end of season 4 so that I could be part of the group frequently chiming in as we get into the best parts of the series. Briefly, a side effect of slow binging the whole series was I was caught off guard when I saw an episode coming out called Tribute to Sean Engel, and maybe this helped me to get a tiny taste of the sense of dismay and loss felt by those listening in real time, realizing that they wouldn't be hearing any more of his obvious and infectious enthusiasm for pop culture. I can't speak for those of you who knew Sean, but just as a listener, I'm glad he got this project started, and I'm glad he shared as much of his fandom as he did with all of us. Free to skip over this third paragraph in this email if it gets too long and tedious to read out loud. Not at all. But I had to comment on the discussion about the alternate universe episodes that occurred to me during the most recent episode. Whilst reading an email, Andy nicely encapsulated why the Mirror Universe has the potential to tell us so much about characters and tell us really dark stories. I agree with both him and the email writer about that, which is why I was a little confused hearing you treat Crossover as mostly a romp. The fun of Crossover is a fascinating character. Her fire and passion are recognizably Kira, but divorced from a cause, they turn her into basically Dukat in a way that the real Kira would find horrifying, and her love of herself becomes simultaneously an expression of narcissism and of loneliness. In marked contrast, Mira Kira, as presented in episodes like Through the Looking Glass and Shattered Mirror, is a cliche villain defined only by being a hot villainess who wears tight cat suits and will screw anything that moves. It might be fun for the actor, but as a viewer, I'm less easily amused. As far as I'm concerned, that's why Crossover, and only Crossover, but definitely not any of DS9's other Mirror Universe trips, is a worthy successor to Mirror Mirror. I won't go over every other agreement and disagreement I have with you guys, except for one thing. You frequently state that DS9 is the best Trek series other than the original. This is not true. As wonderful and iconic as both TOS and TNG are at their best, it is an objective fact that DS9 is the high watermark of the entire Trek franchise. I'm a scientist and will prove it with graphs and stuff if necessary. Ben. I'm going to say thank you to you, Ben, for joining our group. And by all means,
sure. you're always welcome.
We encourage you to send emails with your thoughts.
I'm going to say we can agree to disagree.
I liked his last paragraph. I want to see those charts and graphs.
Yeah. I do too. I feel like I'm. I feel like I'm in Alice's restaurant.
Regarding crossover, I do get what he's saying about Kira. I do get that that was a really nice character moment for Kira, and that, yeah, for the most part, the Mirror Universe's episodes of Deep Space Nine aren't terribly serious, or they don't really dwell upon the ramifications of the character moments.
Yeah, I stand by my review of crossover. I do like that you're pointing out something about it that is interesting, and I agree with your point, but I still stand by my position on it.
I like what he says there, Ben. Sorry, not he. I like what Ben says there about Mirror Kira. I think that's a very valid point about the episode.
Yeah, I do agree with that, but I don't agree with the statement that it's the only worthy success in a Mirror Mirror. If nothing else, In a Mirror Darkly is certainly a worthy successor.
Yeah, because In a Mirror Darkly is entirely in the Mirror Universe, isn't it? Which is what makes it fascinating.
That it came on, yeah, it came at you without any warning. Look, that scene from First Contact, what the...
Yeah, in terms of storytelling, that's one of the bravest Star Treks they've ever done. And that's up there with Yesterday's Enterprise, in that you're thrown right into the story with no explanation, and essentially, as a viewer, you're on the back foot just playing catch-up. And I think that's very brave for episodic television to do that.
I tend to agree. All right, so I guess that will be it for now.
Next time, a new episode of Listen to the Prophets of René Auberjonois steps into the directorial chair for Let He Who Is Without Sin. Worf and Dax go to a pleasure planet. Boom chicka wah wah!
All that is ours is yours.
A planet of pure pleasure.
I've got to take you on vacation more often.
A world of total seduction.
Ryza is famous for its diversions.
The ultimate escape has something for everybody. But the perfect paradise...
Stay where you are.
...is about to become Paradise Lost.
The party's over.
Vanessa Williams guest stars on the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
That's when we discover where the ridges go down to on Worf.
Oh, well...
Ribbed for your pleasure. Oh, yeah.
All right, goodbye, everybody.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
I'm drawing a blank.
Trials and tribulations. Why am I doing Voyager for a Deep Space Nine podcast? It makes no sense. It makes no goddamn sense.
That's it. I'm going to do a Babylon 5 podcast. I'll see you guys.